Right, so you came back and the results look puzzling on the 85-foot.
And then we designed it, we wait until the 140-foot telescope gets into business. However, at the time there was one of the IAU meetings in Hamburg, and Hieschen came back and told us about measurements done by the Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And but they were so noisy and horrible looking that obviously nobody took them serious. And it was quite a strange situation. I will come back to this thing later. So then we got the 140-foot telescope, got into operation, and we installed the 6-centimeter receiver as the first system. But it should first be used for pointing measurements, which was done by a guy with the name De Jong. And then Kellermann, of course, wanted already to look for extragalactic sources, and we could see that at the time the pressure would become bigger and bigger, and we wouldn't get much time to do our line experiment. But then something was fortunate for us and unfortunate for the NIO happened, because when De Jong made the pointing measurements, he saw that the pointing was changing from day to day. And this, of course, was a rather horrible story.
Yeah.
And they found out after about 1 week what has happened. The encoder was rigidly coupled to the elevation axis. No, not the declination axis.
Yeah.
Declination axis. And there was a bend in the thing, and the coupling couldn't take it. And so the bend translated into the encoder.
Yeah.
And somehow bruised the encoder, so to say. And in the process, until we had realized the thing, the encoder was damaged, and it was damaged so much that they had to bring it back to not Ferranti, or some similar name, and to get this thing fixed. And it took them at least 14 days to fix it. And during this time, we had only an encoder which was accurate to about 1 degree, and this is coarse things. And so nobody wanted to use it, at least not Kellermann, who needed exact position. So we had the telescope for 14 days for us. And we, of course, didn't have any problems. We could pick up on strong sources like M17 or Orion.
Right.
So we got the receiver fixed, and we found out what the reason was why we did not find the recombination line with the 85-foot telescope. There was a servo loop for the local oscillator, which worked intermittently, and sometimes it locked the local oscillator to the standard frequency, and sometimes it did not, and when it did, we could see a line, and when it did not, of course, the local oscillator ran away, and we couldn't see anything.
So you were out of luck, essentially, when you weren't seeing the line.
Yeah. Okay, but after this thing was fixed, then in the first night, we worked on it, and we integrated on M17 was the first source. We could already see it on the analog record, and Hyglund took the things, took the measurements back into the computer, which they still had a green bank at the time, after half an hour he came back, and you could see the line sticking out like a sore thumb. It was quite fantastic. And then the next thing was Orion, and but I just didn't believe in it. I stayed there on the telescope until the morning around 10 or 11 o'clock, until we got Cassiopeia and Virgo, and we didn't see a line, and then
right.
I believed it. Okay, we are Cygnus, and I believe we did it, and we actually had the line. In fact, when I go back to my to our publications in Science, where we announced the detection of this line, and we also show the spectra of the non-thermal source, we show for the first time this, at that time we didn't know what it was, this baseline
ripple.
Yeah,
I see.
Baseline ripple.
Little did you know that many years later.
Okay, so this was the story of the recombination lines, and there I just want to mention the following thing. Of course, later on I was interested, why did nobody else look at those recombination lines before Kardashev had published his paper in 59.
Right.
And he had already communicated the results at a IAU meeting in
the Ursi meeting in 58. Or the IAU meeting.
IAU meeting in Moscow. And people were questioning, is this incorrect? And Shklovsky got up and told that he had checked the computations himself. Kardashev was one of his students, and he thinks the thing is right. And why did people not search for those lines? The reason was that they assumed that the Stark effect would wipe out this thing completely. And this came just by applying a theory which was developed for the optical region to extrapolating it to the radio range. And even when people in when the Russians announced the detection of these lines in Hamburg, and all the American radio astronomers were around, again, nobody believed it, because when they came home, when Lilly came home and talked the thing over with Menzel, Menzel was just bullshit. Yeah. They can't see the line. And after we had announced the detection of this line, it took Lilly about 4 or 5 days to retune his 18 centimeter maser for the OH line to and see the lines again. So it's a rather strange thing. Now, as far as the Stark effect goes, a couple of months later I was invited for a colloquium at the University of Maryland by Westerhout. And I was talking to Westerhout about, when we were sitting over a glass of cocktail privately, the strange thing with the Stark effect. And he told me, okay, talk to the expert on this thing. Who is the expert? Yeah, there's Hans Green, and his little daughter is just here for a birthday party, and he will pick her up and talk to him. So I talked to Hans Green, and I could even talk to him in German, because he's coming from Germany. And he told me, oh yeah, yeah, come to my office tomorrow and I'll explain you what the problem is. And so when I came, he had already filled 8 sheets of paper with equations. And he told me, okay, it's not so simple as I thought. And in fact, it turned out it was not so simple. It took him about 3 months to work out the theory of Stark broadening. And they all finally understood, hoped to understand. Today, it looks like he still has overestimated the Stark effect.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's this was the early days of Green Bank. Then, of course, after the detection of the recombination lines, we did these surveys of recombination lines. I did them primarily in cooperation with Bernie Burke and his students, Tom Wilson, and Ted Reifenstein.
Mm-hmm.
These surveys, which we first did with the NIO telescope for the Northern Hemisphere, and then later on, Tom Wilson and I went to Australia and did it again with Frank Gardner and Doug Millen for the southern H2 region. They were aimed of investigating the large scale structure of the Milky Way. In other efforts, as far as the helium lines and the carbon lines were concerned, I cooperated with the people from Harvard at Lilly and Zuckerman and Fred Palmer. So this was the setup. We also continued our work on continuum observations of H2 regions, especially on high-resolution observations.
All right, before you go any further, let me just ask about the early days at NREO. So you were there after Struve had gone.
Yes.
Right. So you weren't that early, but I was just trying to get a feel for what sort of place did it seem like when you were there. Was it all working well,
No, I came there in 63, and just a couple of months ago, Heeshan had been named director of the NIO. You know, Pawsey was supposed to come and got his brain tumor and never could take over. So at that time, the NIO was apparently very heavily under attack by other American radio astronomers. And they had a visiting committee, and when this visiting committee convened, they obviously only said very nasty things about the radio astronomy as a sink of money and so on and so on.
The money should go to the universities.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
So, when I came, the situation has... There were still these very heavy attacks from outside, but inside the organization, I met an organization which was impressed me very much. There was with Heeshan, there was a man, a very strong-minded man, who had a clear idea how to organize this place. I did not agree fully at the time with all his decisions, for example, that he felt the receivers and the telescopes had to be operated in a way that an outside observer could come and use the thing without diving into the details of this instrument and so on. I did not agree with this thing, but later on I found out it was the only right thing to do, because it was a national institute and it had to serve a purpose. I think also in the opinion of the outside, the NIO had gone through its lowest point with the successful operation of the 300-foot telescope. It was a cheap instrument, was built in very short time, and it was primarily the merit of John Findlay to get his instrument working, and it just had started to work a couple of months before I arrived.
When was the lowest point?
Must have been probably in 61, 62.
Before the 300 foot?
Before the 300 foot, yeah. 300 foot was the first thing where, where you had an instrument in this place in Greenbank, which was outstanding, and people came. In fact, when I was around at that time, the first people to use this instrument efficiently was Bernie Burke and Ken Turner.
Yeah, he told me he's the first one to use it, I think.
Yes, and they came with a, they had their spectrometer in a van, and they had a clockwork which scans the channels. And Westerhout was around too, and wanted to use or used it even, and they had a scanning feed.
Mm-hmm.
However, in the scanning feed, they had forgotten that there's a beam factor that they scanned at a to higher rate.
I see.
You see, there's a tilt angle and the of the feed and the tilt angle of the beam are not the same. The tilt angle of the beam is smaller.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, Frank Drake left for JPL, and then later on for Cornell. Yes, but I had the feeling there was an organization which was over the hump, and you could see how the spirit was improving every day. They got people with good reputation like Morton Roberts came in. So I must say I did not never see the observatory, the low days. I only saw it going up.
But what created these? The fact that they only had the 85 foot and it wasn't so great a telescope after all? Or?
You know, the 85 foot telescope was not so great a telescope. The place was horrible. I mean, you just couldn't get a good man to come to Greenbank for a long time because...
To live there.
To live there, yes. I mean, it's a small place and was very underdeveloped at that time. You had to drive 80 miles to Elkins in order to go shopping. The wives didn't like it. They had some trouble with the school and all kinds of things played together.
And when was the move to Charlottesville?
It was in 66 or 67. I think 67.
So that was after the things started going up, in your opinion, anyway.
And then, of course, the big jump came with the taking into operation the 140-foot telescope. This was really the big thing.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the construction of the 140-foot telescope was marred with problems, all kinds of problems. And the last one, which I remember still very lively, was when they had to turn the reflector around, which was built face down, and in order to mount it, they had to turn it around, and they.
You mean they had to pick it up?
Yes.
Like so.
Pick it up like so and turn it around.
Right.
And they had fixed two cranes on the in this what they felt was the center of gravity, and then took a small one to turn the thing around. And they didn't get the center of gravity right, and so the pull on this little crane, which had to pull the thing over, was much too much too large, and the rope broke, and the reflector was swinging back and rammed into the ground. This is all very dramatically shown in a movie, which...
I've seen that movie a long time ago, but I didn't remember that scene was in there.
Perhaps they have taken it out. It wasn't very much appreciated.
It was when I was an undergraduate in 65.
Yeah, okay, there are two movies, one which is shown to the normal spectators, and one which was which was done on the request of the manager of the 140-foot telescope. What's his name? Small...
About the real story.
Real story. It showed all the problems, and therefore was not very much liked by the associated universities. But there you can, you see this, it's a beautiful color picture, and you see this little crane, and you also hear the sound. And then you hear how the alarm bell starts to ring, because there's an overload.
All right, and the crane.
And you see the man, the crane operator, jumping out of his crane and flying, and then you hear bang when this rope cracks and the receiver swings back.
It's not really funny, but it sounds...
But nothing happens. This machine is so heavy, obviously.
so it didn't damage the reflector?
No, didn't damage the reflector. And otherwise, this thing went very, very smoothly, and apart from this pointing encoder business, everything...
Did that get straightened out quickly?
Yes, it was about 14 days it was straightened out, and they put in a belly coupling, which then could take the strain and so on. We had always constantly, we had problems with the 140 foot telescope with the hydraulic system. The operators and knew how to solve these problems. So I think it turned out to be one of the most successful and most efficiently operated telescopes.
So once it was built, then there were not many problems. It was only in the actual building that.
Yes, it was in the actual building, yeah. And I think at several stages, as far as I know, they wanted to terminate as a construction. At one stage, turned out they used the wrong steel, which then became started to crack at low temperatures and all kinds of things. You could still see all the those spare parts which they had taken out. They were still running, lying around the 140 foot telescope. But then the thing went up, and I think Heaton's policy paid off. That he was leaning over backward to give service to the universities. It was so that sometimes the staff members were quite fed up with the thing, seeing that outside people came and didn't know too much about observations, but got the bulk of the observing time.
Right.
But on the long run, I think his policy paid off, and
because now
what gave him the support, yeah. Which changed this wave of hatred against the NIO, and gave support, and eventually led to the result that the whole astronomical community was supporting the VLA.
Yeah. Okay, well, I don't want to take it much later than 67 or so. That's about where you've gotten to, I think.
Yeah.
Because it's just, you know, I got to stop somewhere. It gets a little bit too much out of hand.
Yeah.
But now, were you involved at all in the 100 meter telescope in the mid 60s? Can you tell me anything about that from your point of view?
No, I can only tell the story as far as von Hommer is involved. Von Hommer was involved in so far. As in, I think it was 65 probably, 64, 65. The professor for astronomy and the director of the observatory in Tübingen had died, Siedentopf, and Sebastian von Hommer was invited to for this chair of Siedentopf in Tübingen, and but von Hommer at that time was deeply involved in fascinated by cosmology, and he found out that moon occultations was a good way of measuring, getting high angular resolution, and then he realized that the existing antennas were not big enough, and so he looked, how can you build antennas, and then in typical von Hommer way, he started to get involved in the construction of antennas himself, and went down to the bases and started again, and in fact he later on worked for 5 or 6 years on this problem and came out with a solution of homology. But anyhow, when they asked him if he wanted to come back to Germany, he made it clear that he would only come back if he got a radio telescope. And then some people pointed out to him that the best way to get some money would be through the Volkswagen Foundation. Now, obviously, at the same time, here people in Bonn, Pekka and Hachenberg had also plans for a large radio telescope. And then they heard about von Hommer, they also applied to the Volkswagen Foundation. And so there were two proposals for two large antennas, one in the conservative construction by Krupp and MAN and Bonn, and the other one in the homology construction by Sebastian von Hommer.
Were they as big as 100 meters?
I think he was even talking about a 150 meter telescope or something like this. He wanted it only for lower frequencies. He was not interested in high frequencies. Well, and so the Volkswagen Foundation was faced with two proposals, and they had to make a choice. And they asked an institution, which is called the Rat Westdeutsche Sternwarten, where all the directors are involved, get together, and they should give advice. And their advice, of course, came off built, as you can expect, built those instruments. And so the Volkswagen Foundation was again faced with a problem. And then they made made a very rather clever decision. They told the two parties
Yeah.
You get some money, provided you find an institution which gives you the operational budget, which was still, I mean, the rule of thumb is about 10% of the investment costs, and both of them were given 18 million Deutschmarks, and so they had to find a budget, a yearly budget of 1.8 million Deutschmark, mm-hmm. which was, even at that time, a pretty high amount of money.
Yeah.
And a large amount of money. So it was clear that no university, neither Tübingen nor Bonn, could bring up this money. And von Hörner, who originally came out as a Max Planck Gesellschaft, he got his thesis with von Weizsäcker and Heisenberg.
Which Max Planck Institute?
That was the Max Planck Institute for Physics and Astrophysics, Heisenberg-Biermann Institute.
Yeah.
He applied to the Max Planck Gesellschaft and tried to interest them, and it must have just be a lucky time, because the Max Planck Gesellschaft realized that radio astronomy was one of the big ventures. And so they immediately reacted, and within short time they started to found laser base basic framework for Max Planck Institute for radio astronomy. However, then they did also the reasonable thing, because they said it is impossible to have two large observatories in Germany. So we are going to support an institute, but Bonn and Tübingen have to work together. And the idea was probably that the telescope design from Bonn was the more realistic mm-hmm. design. On the other hand, the scientific support by Sebastian von Hörner would be would make a better scientific use of the instrument. And so I think it was, from the point of view of the Max Planck Gesellschaft, it was a reasonable thing to get the two groups together. But von Hörner didn't like the idea, and so after 1 year of negotiating, he just told them, okay, I'm no longer interested. And he was already appointed the first director of the of this Max Planck Institute, and Hachenberg the second. And so von Hörner decided no, and he stepped out. And then Hachenberg was, for 2 years or so, he was the only director of the institute.
When was the institute created now? What year?
Let me see, it must have been 66 or 67. It was the final decision was made.
It was officially created then.
Yes. Yeah.
But then it had no staff or anything.
Well, they just had a staff, but a small one.
Yeah.
Yes. They still didn't have the computer people or their own computers, or they didn't have a large electronics division. I think the first real electronic man they had was Zins, who is now head of the electronics division, and Nigel Keane, who came on his various ways, floated into Bonn.
But the money for the telescope wasn't guaranteed yet, or was it?
No, I think they got money to continue their study. And Hachenberg had first asked for two separate studies from Krupp and from MIN, and then it turned out that Krupp had the better idea, this mm-hmm. Sort of inverted umbrella, which you still see, that is the Krupp idea. However, then they forced the two companies to work together. Krupp, of course, being the chief contractor, but MIN had to be in too. I think this was turned out to be a very good and very clever decision, because Krupp is very good in steel construction. MIN is good in all the machinery parts.
But who forced them to work together?
Volkswagen, Werk, or whoever gave the money. I don't know exactly what the management organization was. So when I finally got involved, and I was offered a directorship here at the MPI, in beginning of 1969, when I just came back from Australia, half a year in Australia, the basic plans for the telescope were done. There was not much what we could change, and I felt it would have been silly to do any changes. I saw some weak points and how to put in the receivers and the primary focus box and so on, but I was under the impression this
But this is the conventional design still.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so when I first visited this place here, they had just the concrete basements built, and I saw this square frame on which the telescope is built on the wheels. But that was all. But then within, I think, 9 months or so, the telescope was actually then built and constructed.
But then, where did it happen for the homologist's design?
Well, von Hommel is of course very outspoken about his homology idea, and so probably Krupp and Hachenberg heard of this idea, and so they applied it, but they did not apply it in von Hommel's way, who actually obtained an analytic solution. It means homology, you take a given construction, and you optimize this construction by fiddling around with the various members and trusses until the deflection produces a paraboloid again.
Right, no matter what
So, I mean, the thing is this, the homology does not prevent you from having a good idea about the construction. Only once you have selected a construction, then it helps you to optimize the thing.
I see. And was this actually applied then?
It was not applied in von Hommel's way, but what they did was something rather similar, namely a trial and error. They got this FRAIN program from IBM at that time, and they applied it to their construction, and they computed the deflection, and then they saw that it did not exactly deflect like a paraboloid, so they changed. These were very experienced engineers, they just knew what to change. And they iterated the thing 4 times and they got the homology solution.
I see.
Which may not be the optimum, but it is good enough. But I think it was the reason that this telescope is so close to a homology telescope, or is a homology telescope in this way, is because Krupp, in its basic construction, had this built-in, this radial symmetry in the construction with those trusses mm-hmm. all around. So it is a homology telescope. But it does not go directly back to von Hommel's.
Not from the beginning.
Not from the beginning.
It was a little bit accidental that they hadn't had this design that worked out well.
I mean, if you go like this, intuitively all the constructors had felt that they had to introduce some spherical symmetry if they wanted, and otherwise you always face a problem. You have a telescope, a reflector with radial symmetry, and then you have to support it in
like
two
the
total
bank.
And I think Hachenberg was aware of this thing too, because he was looking into a construction whereby can you support a reflector on 4 points or 8 points and so on. So the idea was in the air. Krupp did it on a trial and error basis. Von Hommel looked for an analytical solution. And I think nowadays von Hommel's solution is widely used even by people like Krupp, but at that time it was not used.
Are there any other telescopes that have been used, homology telescopes?
Oh yeah, Krupp built a 25 meter telescope for space tracking, and then in the design study for millimeter wave telescopes, which Krupp did in parallel with the NIO after I had arrived here, homology was widely used in telescopes, and so all millimeter wave telescopes which are in the moment offered by Krupp, or maybe they are built one day, are all derivatives of our design study, which again is based on the homology.
I see.
So the homology has found wide application. And,
how did it happen? See, Krupp was the contractor for the Parkes dish.
Or
is
that
mine?
It was MIM.
Okay, I get mixed up.
Yeah.
I see. So it was Krupp's basic design, you said, for the... So that's why it doesn't look very much like the Parkes dish, even though...
Even though
MIM was involved in both.
You have to be aware that MIM was only the was not the designer. The designer of the Parkes dish was Freeman and Fox.
Oh yeah, that's right.
So Krupp sticks more. MIM stuck more to the very heavy, rigid design. For example, they built a 36 meter telescope for the German Ministry of Defense, which is probably an excellent telescope, even down to 8 millimeters. But boy, it's heavy, and it's sitting inside a radon, and they didn't trust in homology or deflection or things like that.
Yeah, brute force.
Yeah.
So in both cases, they were mainly the people that built it, as opposed to designing it.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Well, I think that that covers things pretty well, unless you think of Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That finishes the interview with Peter Metzger on 22nd November 1973.